Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Thank you, Professor Verma, for the kind introduction. It's really a delight to be here. And I'll talk about the concept of International Criminal Responsibility for Individuals, the ICRI, and the foundational transformation of international law. International law is going through a foundational transformation, I'll call. On the one hand, states are no longer the only subjects of international law, and on the other hand, state consent is no longer the only source of international law's legitimacy. And these are certainly two intertwining aspects, and now I can bring the ICRI concept into this transformation of international law. My conclusion is that the ICRI concept has two effects on this transformation of international law. On the one hand, it's an important initiator of this transformation, but on the other hand, it also brings confusions and fragmentations into the international legal order. And there's one root cause for this mixed effect, that's the conflicted philosophical foundations and rationales within the ICRI concept, especially the conflicted perception about individuals and abstract entities in the commission of international crimes. And before my analysis, I should first emphasize that I regard the Nuremberg trial as the actual origin of the ICRI concept. This is, of course, not to deny that enforcement of the laws and customs of war through the punishment of individuals can go back to a much earlier time, but to emphasize that the concept of international criminal responsibility for individuals in its true sense was only brought to life after the Second World War as a direct result of the Nuremberg trial. International criminal responsibilities need to be international. Therefore, earlier punishment of individuals based on domestic, religious, or natural law cannot really be the origin of the ICRI concept. And the ICRI concept must also be understood with its foundational importance to the identity of international criminal law as a whole. As Schwarzenberger once said, international criminal law in a real sense would have to be of a prohibitive character and would have to be strengthened by punitive sanctions of their own. Well, prohibitive prescription can be found from various sources of international law, such as the laws and customs of the war. It is the actual enforcement of the punitive sanction based on the ICRI concept that gives international criminal law its true and own identity. And such an actual enforcement of international criminal responsibilities for individuals did not exist until the Nuremberg Tribunal. So let's first see the ICRI concept as an important initiator of this transformation of international law. The role of the ICRI in propelling the pluralization of the subjects of international law is quite obvious. Before the Nuremberg Tribunal, states are regarded as the only subjects of international law, and therefore only states can be held responsible under international law, and the responsibilities of individuals remain a matter of domestic law. But the Nuremberg Tribunal makes international law directly address the responsibilities of individuals, and therefore directly address individuals as the subjects, by the famous quotation or the dictum that the crimes against international law are committed by men, not by abstract entities. And only by punishing individuals can the provisions of international law be enforced. This essentially transformed the philosophical and conceptual foundation of international law in a substantial way. The reach of international law is no longer presumed to be limited to a certain actors, which are accordingly defined as the subjects, and everything else is defined as the object of international law. Instead, an actor would be regarded as a subject of international law if doing so can serve the purpose of the international legal order. And it's quite clear that the Nuremberg Tribunal used and emphasized justice as a very important purpose of the international legal order to justify that individuals should bear direct criminal responsibilities under international law. In addition to propelling this pluralization of the subjects of international law, the establishment of ICRI was also a very important example of international lawmaking beyond the dogmas of traditional positivism. The sort theory of international law reflects the dependence of international law's legitimacy on state consent, because both customary international law and treaties are based on state consent, be it explicit or tacit. Although the Nuremberg Tribunal insisted that the ICRI contained in the Charter of the International Military Tribunal was merely declaratory of existing customary international law, there is no doubt that the Charter was creating new laws. The defense attorney did argue before the tribunal that as to the breach of the peace, there is no international criminal responsibilities for individuals. And in particular, he argued that the act of individual perpetrators are in fact the acts of the state, which contradicts with the tribunal's perception that international crimes are committed by men, not by abstract entities. The defense attorney's arguments were, of course, brushed off by the tribunal. By citing the Treaty of Versailles and the U.S. Supreme Court case of Quirin, the Nuremberg Tribunal simply stated that many other authorities could be cited, but enough has been said to show that individuals could be punished for violations of international law. And this tribunal's reasoning is clearly flawed from the perspective of positivist international law, since many other authorities were indeed not cited. So the tribunal based its reasoning entirely on Article 228 of the Treaty of Versailles and the U.S. Supreme Court case of Quirin, but neither can sufficiently support existence of ICRI. Reference to the Treaty of Versailles is problematic because individual criminal responsibilities under Article 228 is of a domestic rather than international character. And reference to the Quirin case is also problematic because the issue to be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court is whether the detention of primarily German petitioners violated the law and constitution of the United States. The Supreme Court did not have to determine whether individuals could be held criminally responsible for international crimes. So here we can clearly see a paradigm transformation of international law with the establishment of the ICRI concept. Traditional positivism is rejected as the unchallengeable methodology of international law, and state and their consent therefore no longer monopolize the legitimacy of international law. And concepts like fundamental values, such as the value of justice and the international community as a whole, are becoming more and more visible in the international legal discourse. Not only does the ICRI concept bring transformation in a general way, it also transformed the landscape of the international legal order by giving birth to a whole new discipline of international criminal law. International criminal law has a unique legal character that is individual or individualistic orientation, because the whole discipline deals with international criminal responsibilities for individuals and not states and other collective entities. And this is clearly premised on the powerful dictum that crimes against international law are committed by men, not by abstract entities. But I will argue here today that the philosophical foundations behind the ICRI concepts are in fact much more complicated than that. And the role of abstract entities and collective criminality is essential to the conceptualization of the ICRI concept. As a foundational important concept of international criminal law, the ICRI concept has two important questions. First, the individuals are responsible for what? And this leads to the concept or definition of international crimes. And the second question is, who exactly are responsible? And this question leads to the most of liability. Let's first look at the role of abstract entities and collective criminalities in the conceptualization of international crimes. First, aggression. Aggression is by definition a crime of state because international law defines aggression as the illegal use of force of one state against another state. And there's also an inbuilt presumption against the idea that individual can commit genocide independently of any state or state-like instrumentalities. According to the Rome Statute, genocide is committed with the intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. And this would require a degree of planning and organization that typically goes beyond the capacity of all but state or state-like instrumentalities. And a similar presumption of collective structure is also articulated in a definition of the crimes against humanity, which needs to be committed as a part of widespread or systematic attack. And for war crimes, although it could be carried out by individual perpetrators on their own initiative and in disregard of the orders of the authorities under which they function, in fact, most cases, they constitute the crime of obedience, which is a crime and acts performed in response to the orders from the authority. The collective structure of abstract entities has also a role to play in the allocation of international criminal responsibilities for individuals under the modes of liability doctrines. Admittedly, international criminal responsibility could be imposed on purely individual acts. When a person committed a war crime or crimes against humanity, against or without the authority of the collective entity. But in most cases, individuals are held criminally responsible under international law precisely due to their participation in the collective system. And to this day, international criminal law has developed several liability vehicles such as conspiracy, joint criminal enterprise, and commander or superior responsibility to capture the essence of this criminal collective structure in the commission of international crimes. And under those doctrines, international criminal responsibility is allocated to individuals precisely because of the structure of a collective criminality. The commission of international crimes usually entails the cooperation of a large number of people in the established network, and the act and mind of no one single person is sufficient for the whole crime. Therefore, the requirement on individual's guilty mind is loosened to a certain extent when the law prescribes on the structural role of individuals in the collective system. For example, under the doctrine of joint criminal enterprise, the requirement on mens rea could be loosened when the crime is a natural and foreseen incident of that enterprise. And also under the doctrine of superior responsibility, the key component is not mens rea, but the obligation to prevent, which is quite identical to the obligation of states under customary international law. So we can see here now that to claim international crimes are committed by men but not abstract entities is not only oversimplified but also not really correct. In most cases, international crimes are committed by individuals and the collective system they form simultaneously. Individuals and the abstract entities are mutually dependent legal perceptions, and there is no basis in law, philosophy, or logic to give either one a metaphysical priority. In this sense, although the ICRI concept itself is not about the responsibilities of states or other collective entities, the existence of ICRI per se implies criminality of the abstract entities in international law. Now that we have reviewed this conflicted image about individuals and abstract entities within the ICRI concept, we can see how it has brought confusions and fragmentations into the international legal order. And the issue of foreign immunity for torture in domestic civil proceedings is a good example. While the immunity of the foreign state itself remains a requirement of customary international law, there is no consensus as to whether the individual perpetrators of torture should also enjoy immunity in a domestic civil proceeding. On the one hand, it's tempting to lift the immunity of those individual torturers, especially because prohibition of torture is already a jus cogens norm under general international law. But on the other hand, torture in international law is defined as the official act of the state. So in this sense, state immunity should extend to individual perpetrators for their official acts. Since these two approaches cannot really be reconciled, international law is in the status of fragmentation to this point, and it's really up to the domestic states themselves to decide whether they want to prioritize immunity or providing a remedy to jus cogens violations in a domestic civil suit. And while the majority of states still uphold immunity of the individual perpetrators of torture, a few states have chosen to lift the immunity of those individual torturers. But there has been some rather troubling and unplausible reasoning in domestic jurisprudence to indicate that the reason why immunity is lifted is because torture as a jus cogens violation cannot be the act of the state. And this once again falls into the trap of claiming that violation of international laws are committed by individuals, not the abstract entities. And this argument is not only wrong because torture is the official act of the state under international law, but also harmful because it cuts the possibility and denies states responsibility for torture. And we should always keep in mind that it's precisely because of this official and state-sanctioned nature that makes torture such a horrible and despicable crime, not the other way around. Just as individuals can no longer hide their guilt behind the state, the ICR concept should also not be used to hide state's guilt behind the individuals. There is no doubt that it's one of the most important contribution achievements of contemporary international law to hold individual perpetrators accountable for some of the most severe violations of international law. But this should in no way mislead us into believing that the transformation of international law should end with individuals as the only structural or philosophical foundation of the international legal order. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.